The Sharp series was established in 2011 in honor of Richard L. Sharp, a nationally recognized entrepreneur, to present competing views on topics crucial to our nation and global society. Sharp was a recognized thought leader and an exemplar of personal and professional integrity who served as a mentor to aspiring businessmen and community leaders. Among his many roles, Mr. Sharp served as chairman of the board at Circuit City, CarMax, and Crocs Incorporated. Mr. Sharp was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's in late 2010, but continued to demonstrate his values of leading by example until his death in 2014. The university is celebrating its commitment to Mr. Sharp's vision by engaging prominent thought leaders with different perspectives on hotly debated issues, including free speech, immigration, and identity. I am honored and pleased this evening to introduce you to our thought leader for the evening, Dr. Jeffrey Herbst, scholar and former president and CEO of the Newseum. Dr. Herbst formerly served as president of Colgate University, a professor at Princeton University, and provost of Miami University in Ohio, a role which I was also honored to serve in. As CEO of the Newseum, Dr. Herbst spoke frequently and passionately about the First Amendment and recent attacks on these basic freedoms, notably on college campuses. Indeed, recent events and incidents across the nation from Middlebury College to the University of California, Berkeley to Evergreen State College reflect not free expression, but the dangerous encroachment of censorship. Dr. Herbst writes, quote, "Wanting to censor those whose views one finds odious and offensive is understandable. Actually, silencing them is dangerous, though, because censorship is a two-way street. It is an illusion for groups to believe that they can censor the speech of others today without having their own expression muzzled tomorrow." End of quote. So tonight, we offer an antidote to censorship by engaging in candid and unmuzzled conversation about the First Amendment and particularly its role on college campuses. We encourage you to ask questions of our speaker. We hope you saw the cards that were available to submit your questions as you entered the Quealy Center. I am thankful and grateful to our provost, Dr. Jeffrey LeGros, and the head of our director of our scholars and fellows office, Dana Kukum, for curating those questions for us. So please, I hope you saw those cards and have given them. So I'm also pleased to share to tell you that you can share your own perspectives by mentioning UR, that's at URichmond on Twitter, or by using the hashtag at URSharp. That's at URichmond on Twitter or the hashtag at URSharp. We're very much looking forward to this evening's discussion, so let's get started with the first question. So welcome, Dr. Herbst. We're pleased to have you with us.
Thank you.
This evening. So I want to begin just by a little background on what you've been doing most recently. You were, until recently, the CEO of the Newseum. Exactly what is the Newseum?
Well, first let me say it's a pleasure and honor to be here at the university. And in fact, I was the president's successor as provost at Miami. So we've had a long professional association. Pleasure to be with him today. Pleasure to be here. I must admit, the only other time I've been in Richmond was to go to the NASCAR race, which is also a great endeavor, but it's wonderful to be here with you tonight. So, and thank you very much for inviting me to be part of the Sharp Viewpoint series. I've been very concerned over the last few years at the Newseum about our First Amendment freedoms, all five of them, which of course are religion, press, speech, petition, and assembly. In addition to the traditional concerns, there have always been controversies about free speech, free press, religion in the United States. Recently, we've seen, I'd say, an acceleration of those concerns. College campus controversies that the president mentioned. I've been very interested in how social media has disrupted journalism and how so much of our public discourse today happens on platforms that are in fact provided by private companies, something that's happened almost in an instant without any public discussion. And of course, there are also very significant religious freedom issues around marriage equality and lots of other controversies. So it's been really fascinating to look at these issues. I'd say overall, as a First Amendment advocate, this is the greatest moment ever for free speech and free press. The web is the First Amendment realized. 17-year-olds can have 10 million followers on YouTube without spending any money whatsoever. We've never seen anything like that. Not surprisingly, in that kind of revolution, there are also problems. And we have to deal with those, and there are all problems, among other places, on college campuses.
Thank you. In 2016, the Knight Foundation conducted surveys to ascertain the extent to which high school and college students understand and support the First Amendment. Now, I know the museum was involved with that survey. Would you share with us what you learned from that 2016 survey?
Sure. Knight Foundation has conducted very important survey work, and the Newseum Institute also very important survey work. We found a couple of things. First, young people say overwhelmingly, over 90%, that they are committed to free speech and especially political expression, and that they understand those rights. This is not a question of, so often said, they just don't understand the Constitution. We also found, however, and other studies have also documented, that a very significant number, perhaps a majority, of young people in the ages you mentioned believe that speech which is considered offensive to particular people or particular groups should be regulated or controlled. That they essentially believe in a carve-out of the First Amendment for speech that is offensive, especially offensive to minorities or other groups who are seen as not particularly powerful in society. That's a new development. And young people believe that at a much higher frequency than other age groups, if you look at it. So it's not, as often portrayed, ignorance, they don't understand. This is kind of, and I wrote a white paper on this, an alternative understanding of free press and free speech in this country, and it really has to be disentangled, and something I know we'll talk about tonight.
Thank you, Jeff. You said, and I quote, "It's almost a rule of democratic physics that restrictions on rights eventually will hurt the least powerful in society." Would you tell us who is most vulnerable when rights are restricted?
This is a change in our society. If you look at the civil rights movement in the 1960s, Dr. King and his colleagues were adroit and deeply committed to using all five freedoms to press for the eventual goal of equality in our society. And in fact, thanks to the technology people at Richmond, I want to play a little clip of Dr. King's last speech. It was given 3 days before he was assassinated in Memphis. It's commonly called, "I've Been to the Mountaintop." I'm going to play about 2 minutes of the speech where he talks about the First Amendment.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. And so just as I say we aren't going to let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't going to let any injunction turn us around? Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Three days later, he would be killed. And either through prescience or prophecy, he somehow understood that. And what he was talking about 3 days before he was killed was the First Amendment. Because he understood that the powerful don't need rights. They'll get their way. It's people who are alienated, people who are outside of the political structure, who need rights. And one of the things that has happened in our society is that since the civil rights struggle, some minority groups, and we find, for instance, in our polling, African American students, have become deeply skeptical of First Amendment rights, which is a reversal from the civil rights movement. And I think that is unfortunate, because if speech, if assembly is to be regulated, then eventually it will be bounced back on those who are least powerful.
Thank you, Jeff. Colleges and universities have recently canceled controversial speakers due to threats of violence. How do educational institutions balance First Amendment rights with the kind of real violence and loss of life that occurred in Charlottesville?
Right. Well, I know, of course, our colleagues are deeply concerned about the safety of their students and faculty, and they're also, of course, deeply committed to free speech. I think, in general, colleges and universities have done poorly in terms of protecting the rights around free speech and promoting as much dialogue as possible, in part because they haven't been prepared. We've seen over the last 2 or 3 years that many schools just weren't prepared on the ground on how to deal with were not particularly difficult protests. They just didn't have the people, the decision structure. And a lot of work has been done to teach institutions across the country best practices. For instance, many college student codes say disruptions aren't allowed, but they don't define what a disruption is. So a lot of work has to be done on the ground as far as best practices. I'm very sympathetic to people who immediately after Charlottesville canceled neo-Nazis like Richard Spencer because of fears about violence, but I'm also worried that that will become a long-term excuse to tamp down on debate, however odious the speakers. For instance, some of the people who have turned down, some of the campuses that have turned down the neo-Nazis because of fears of safety, they tend to be very large public schools, for instance, that have very big athletic programs. And on football Saturdays, they mobilize hundreds of law enforcement professionals to regulate fan behavior and promote safety, sometimes take over entire college towns, redo parking, crowd control. Hundreds of people involved, helicopters, ambulances are on site. They can do all that, but they're worried about a speaker. That seems to me a poor balance. So I think we have to get back to the point where we're saying, look, this is really important. And we as individual campuses have to take responsibility for safety. For instance, one of the things that happens sometimes is the campus group invites a speaker. the college administration suddenly realizes, wow, this is going to be difficult, and says to the student group, oh, you should pay for the additional public safety officers. That's a mistake. Public safety is responsibility of the administration. They should pay. And then finally, surrounding towns have to be supportive also. I note that the new Chancellor of Berkeley has been very out front in promoting free speech and saying who he's going to invite and support in terms of student invitations. But the mayor of Berkeley has been much more ambivalent. It's the mayor's responsibility also to promote public safety. So I think we have to get back to the First Amendment understanding, which public schools have to adhere to and private schools should adhere to, which is unless there are true threats of credible expressions of violence, then we should promote free expression.
Thank you. You recently wrote about violence in Charlottesville, quote, "It is possible to mourn the death of Ms. Heather Heyer and be repulsed by the views expressed by the alt-right and still support the rights of white supremacists to speech and assembly." Can you explain your thoughts behind these words?
Well, on the first instance, all people have those rights. And one of the things that jurisprudence around the First Amendment has made clear is viewpoint discrimination is not allowed. That is, you can't say you don't have First Amendment rights to speech or assembly because you believe something. That's not allowed in our system. If you are making a true threat, that is a credible threat of imminent violence, your speech, your assembly can be regulated. But just as a constitutional understanding, everyone has those rights. Now, if they commit crimes during their assembly, if someone is run down, then of course they should be prosecuted. But there is no ability to discriminate on the basis of viewpoint. I was saddened that my friends at the ACLU have changed their position. They used to be adamant in protecting the rights of assembly of all. And this got them into great controversies of allowing, of promoting the rights of Nazis to march in Skokie, which was a majority Jewish neighborhood in the 1970s. And of course, they sided with the marchers in the run-up to the Charlottesville protests. Now they've said, we're not going to litigate in favor of people who carry weapons openly. That, in this Commonwealth, is allowed as part of peaceable assembly. That's what your elected officials have decided. And I think that's a retreat from their traditional position, their maximalist position, of promoting free assembly for all, and I think that's a mistake. Second, speaking now as a Jew, I had a lot invested also in Charlottesville. I thought it was important that the Klan and the Nazis be allowed to march according to the permits they were given, because it's important for America to see that these people exist. Yeah, we could pretend they don't exist by not giving them permits, be illegal, but you could try, or throwing them off servers, but still be there. And I think the real issue is not, can we cover up their presence? But the real issue is we have to confront, why do we have this phenomenon? Why do we have people, and I must say this is one of the most extraordinary things coming out of Charlottesville, why do we have people who were born in 1995 who identify with the Klan or with Nazis? And I think that says something about America which we have to confront directly, and we can only confront it if we allow it to be visible.
And just one other question here. With respect to the guns, I mean, because I realize we allow people to carry guns. I mean, where is the line crossed with respect to just public safety? Or is it the role of those who are, policemen, et cetera, who are there to protect the citizens to intercede if they see things getting out of hand?
Well, it's of course, in the first instance, the legislature's role. Mm-hmm. That kind of march with that kind of public display of weapons would not have been allowed where I lived in the District of Columbia because they have a different set of gun laws. Wouldn't have been allowed in New York or New Jersey or I think Ohio where I lived previously. So in the first instances, And this is not a First Amendment or a Second Amendment issue, because D.C. and New Jersey and New York doesn't allow that kind of public display, and there's no Second Amendment issue either. It's what this state has allowed. So I think in the first instance is what your elected representatives have decided. And then second, law enforcement officers do have to make decisions on the ground. And here I'm deeply sympathetic to them. These are very difficult situations happening in real time, where people can play the tape endlessly afterwards and critique, but they're right there on the ground and they have to make a call. Whether they were prepared enough, whether they had a game plan, these are things which we'll understand upon review. But we put people on the ground to make difficult decisions, but only in the context of the laws that our legislatures pass.
So staying with Charlottesville for another question, what impact do you think that the events in Charlottesville will have on the whole notion of freedom of expression, either positive or negative?
I like to be an optimist, so I gave you my optimistic scenario that people will see, oh, this is what's been revealed about a stratum of American society, and we should take note and try to do something about it. On the negative side, if you want to be a pessimist, I think it has given energy to people who want to curtail assembly and speech on the basis of viewpoints, whether it be through permits, whether it be through speaking on college campuses, or whether it be, and this is a really big issue, on the internet. Some of you may know that the CEO of Cloudflare, which controls, which about 10% of the internet traffic goes through, in one of these very large back office operations that people don't understand very well. He woke up like 2 days after Charlottesville said, wow, I really hate the Daily Stormer, they're off my servers. It was actually against his own company policy. Now, it wasn't a First Amendment issue per se, because he's a private company and the First Amendment's about a government. He can have on his servers whoever he wants. But we've gotten to a point in this country where most of our political discourse is on these platforms that are controlled by private companies, which at least until now adhered to a position, neutral position in terms of who they allow on. If they're going to get into the role of saying, you're on, you're off, I don't like you, I like you, then it's going to be a challenge. Because, like I said, while it's not a First Amendment issue, it's an issue about freedom of speech on in our society. And if some websites are thrown off today, you can bet tomorrow some other websites, which perhaps some people have greater allegiance to, will also be thrown off. And so I think we've reached a delicate point in our society where sometimes we seem more interested in talking about stamping out the visible signs of the pathology rather than confronting the pathology itself.
And one question, and this will be the last of these questions which have been prepared by, contributed to by the Richmond Scholars, and we'll take some questions from the floor. According to the most recent Gallup poll, Americans trust and confidence in the media, quote, to report the news fully, accurately, and fairly, has dropped to its lowest level ever. To about 32% said that they have a great deal of fair amount of trust in the media. This is down from 2015 when it was about 72%. Down from 2015 and significantly down from 1972. After the Vietnam War, when it was about 72%. To what do you attribute this drop, and how can media reestablish trust among Americans?
That's a very big issue. First, Americans' trust in all institutions has declined over the last 35 years, except for the military. If you look at corporations, banks, Congress, just about everything else, we've become less trusting as a society, except for the armed forces. So part of the phenomena is a more general phenomena about what's happening in our increasingly untrusting society. Then I think, as far as the media is concerned, you've had a perfect storm of concerns about media bias, the financial collapse, the collapse of the financial models which supported newspapers and now cable television so that they're able to report less, and the rise finally of social media and especially Facebook, where people are no longer dependent on a few sources to get their news, and where there is not much news. A generation ago, there was news scarcity, and three television networks and two or three newspapers provided the news to most Americans. Now, there's a hyperabundance of news, and via Facebook especially, you can sort out what you hear and what you don't want to hear. And you just can increasingly say, I don't want to listen to those sources. In the past, you might have had to read the New York Times and listen to Walter Cronkite because that was the only things available. Now, you can construct a perfect little ecosystem on your social media, if you'd like, and only listen to the sources that you think will probably agree with you, and you increasingly are distrust and are alienated from the other sources. And finally, our society has become more polarized politically. If you look at the data and you array American society from extremely conservative to somewhat conservative to neutral, somewhat liberal, extremely liberal, you'll find that the people in the middle tend to have a pretty heterogeneous news consumption. They read, they listen to various sources, and the people at either pole tend to have more homogeneous news sources and distrust the other side. And if you look at it, more and more Americans are migrating to the poles, both of them. And the middle is hollowing out. And that's produced also, that's both produced and is caused by this ability to create your own ecosystem. Mm-hmm. What the media has to do, look, we're in a once in a century disruption of an entire industry. It's like what happened to steel 30 years ago. It's what happened to the canals 100 years ago. And what the evidence suggests is, in most of these severe disruptions where your financial model goes away, not much survives to what comes next. Very few companies make the kind of transition that Corning Glass has made, where we used to make glass, now we make the covers to iPhones. That doesn't happen very often. Most of those companies go bankrupt. So what we're in right now is a very difficult middle situation. The legacy companies, the companies of the old order, are having financial troubles. The Daily News in New York was sold yesterday for how much?
$1.
Okay? It's impossible to even get your mind around that. But the Washington Post was sold a few years ago for $250 million, which is like an unimpressive startup in Silicon Valley. So the old order companies are struggling. But we haven't seen the emergence yet of the new order. There are some companies that have been born digital. You'll know some of them, Vox, Vice, BuzzFeed. But they're not, the transition isn't complete yet to them either. So we're in this middle period where we don't quite understand what's going to happen. I think we haven't seen the creation yet of a true set of news products that are fit for the digital age. If you look at what a lot of newspapers are doing in particular, they're just putting, they're producing the same stories they always did, but now they're on the web or being fed to you on your Facebook feed. They haven't changed that much. If we have this entirely new set of communications, then the product is going to have to be different. And finally, I think newspapers, cable TV, in the end, their currency will be credibility, but these days many are often chasing clicks, producing clickbait just to try to get as many eyeballs as possible. That may get eyeballs in the short run. It's not going to make Americans trust you more. So we're in the middle of an unbelievable transition, and we just don't quite know yet what's going to come out the other side in terms of what Americans can actually trust.
Thank you. Thank you. So some other questions here. Our newspaper, the Collegian, that's the name of our student newspaper, has stated that it will not be a platform for white supremacy and neo-Nazism. What is your comment on this, and does this violate free speech?
Well, it doesn't violate First Amendment, because you're a private university, I don't know the legal personality of the newspaper, whether it's part of the school or separately incorporated, but either way, it's not a public institution. So there's not a First Amendment issue. But I think it's a reasonable question to ask is, shouldn't private schools, shouldn't private institutions have ambitions to be at least as free as public schools must be? If they don't have that ambition, I think there's a problem. My own view is, as I said before, pretending that these views don't exist is a mistake, because they will continue. For instance, and again, I'll speak from personal experience as a Jew, there was a big dispute a few years ago of whether Ahmadinejad, who was then the Iranian president, who had vowed to destroy Israel, should be allowed to speak at Columbia University. Columbia had invited him. Huge controversy. How could you allow this guy who wants a physical destruction of the state of Israel to speak? I thought he should speak, because I trusted Americans enough to see what kind of anti-Semite he was, and that he was going to have the same views no matter what, whether he went to Columbia and spoke or not, believe me. And so I thought it was a much better service that Columbia gave him a platform. So I think it's a mistake to say, we're just not going to listen, we're not going to confront these views. If you want to say, we're going to publish these things, but we're going to publish things that disagree and point counterpoint, that's all to the good in promoting debate. But I think the human experience is that not allowing these views to be publicly expressed doesn't keep them from perpetuating and, in some cases, spreading, because they can say, oh, look, again, we've been censored. We've been run out of town. We haven't been allowed to speak. This just goes to show you that it's all rigged against us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And not unrelated to that, this is a question. It said, should free speech be allowed if it inhibits a minority group's free speech?
Well, I don't know the exact scenario. But as I said, I believe that speech should be allowed unless a true threat, that is an imminent threat of violence or disruption that is credible in the relatively short term, is present. I don't know the particular scenario that they're talking about suppressing other people's speech. As I said, I believe the old maxim that the best antidote to speech you don't like is more speech.
Well, let's take that a step further. As an example, in a classroom, a student of color is one of two students of color in the classroom, and a person makes a statement that student of color perceives to be a hateful or racist statement, and nothing is said afterwards by anyone in the class, including the professor. What's an anecdote to that, or how can that be addressed?
I think that's a good question. And believe me, I don't think, and I've thought about this a lot as a provost and a president, I don't think we've trained our faculty, enormously talented as they are, in how to deal with that particular very difficult classroom situation, which I've confronted when it comes to speech which is insulting to minorities or speech which tends to shout down women. I mean, I've seen a lot of it in the classroom. And believe me, I felt professionally challenged as, what do I do in this particular circumstance? I think where we want to end up is making our students strong enough that they can confront and verbalize what they're feeling. That if you feel that someone is insulting you, you should be strong enough, and it's not easy. I recognize that, and it requires the aid of faculty in the room, but you should be strong enough to be able to confront that speech directly. Yeah. And I think that is the best solution. I like Van Jones's formulation. He said, I'm not interested in you being safe, I'm interested in you being strong. I like that formulation.
Yeah. And I think the challenge for us in higher and as professors and staff supporting the students is figuring out a way how to bring the students along on a continuum, because it is difficult. for everyone involved, the student, but as well as the professor, because a lot of times the professors don't know what to say or how to address it.
I mean, I've been in those situations, and I didn't think afterwards my own performance was particularly good. I think this is something we have to think through in terms of the professional development of faculty.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. Please comment on the termination of the Google engineer who took issue with their diversity inclusion policies. Could they have handled the issue better?
Yes. Yes, they could have. Okay, so again, not a First Amendment issue, because Google is a private company, and you would be surprised how limited your speech is in the workplace, for those of you not in the workplace yet. Just like you may be surprised to learn when you enter the workplace that your emails on the company system are not private. They're public. I was once asked at University Senate at Miami, you mean you could read all our emails, one faculty said to me? And I said, yes, but I don't even want to read my emails. So why would I want to read your emails? If he had been at Hallmark or British Petroleum or Costco, wouldn't have been an issue. And I would have said, let the chips fall where they may be. This is an HR issue. The problem is Google is different. And in fact, I went back and read the founder's letter, which is actually one of the most important documents of the 21st century, when two gentlemen founded Google. And they wrote this letter 13 years ago about what kind of company they wanted Google to be. So actually, there are a few more important documents in this era. And they said, at the very beginning, Google is not a regular company, and we don't intend it to be. This company, in a relatively short period of time, has come to control search. It has about 80% of the search market in the United States and up to 95% in Europe. And search, in the age of social media and the web, is incredibly important because it determines what information you get and what information you don't see. So when the company that has an overwhelming control of search says, we're not interested in discourse in our company, that's completely different than when Ford says it. It's completely different, not legally, but because Google has this role in our society which we haven't even begun to confront yet, because it's happened in a few short years and we adjust as a society at a much slower rate than technology moves. And so when the company, which said, and the founder said this, that they were going to embrace free expression because they recognized it was fundamental to search, takes an action which, seen by its own light, is anti-speech, it's a problem, because you're thinking, well, what does it say about all these algorithms, which are essentially black boxes, which we can't understand, which are determining what I see on the web? Most college students, most Americans, by the way, don't go beyond the first page of a Google search. So it's a really powerful thing, what they put up front. And so if the company is saying now, we have a different view, we believe that some expressions are out of bounds, and you could agree or disagree, and it was a complex letter, and I encourage you to read his letter, you could agree or disagree, but that it was Google was an important thing. I think they could have handled it differently. I think the leadership could have said, you're wrong, here's why. They didn't really say a very good reason, but because our business model is search, and because we're so important to American society, we're going to confront this issue head on and have a big debate within our company, rather than off with his head and there he goes. So I think it was a very important issue for Google. Like I said, if it happened at the Ford Motor Company, I'm not sure anyone would have cared.
To what extent can words lead to violence, meaning that they cause harm to others, in other words, suppressing equality, opportunity or the psychological fear of terror?
I think they can, but in our system, that by itself is not usually enough to justify censorship or regulation. So that's the government approach. I think as a society, we have to say, we're interested in figuring out how to confront hateful speech. What are we going to do to confront this? Because I believe that speech may make people feel disempowered. I believe that speech may make them feel alienated. I believe that they may reinforce power structures. I buy all that. I just don't buy that the answer is regulation of speech. I believe it's how can we give everyone the same opportunity to speak out and the same confidence to confront.
This is an interesting question. Are you against any form of speech limitation? For example, asking university students to use different pronouns for different gender identifications?
I'm in favor of the traditional jurisprudence around the First Amendment. When it comes to university speech, like I said, public universities are in different set of regulations than private universities, although I think private universities' ambitions should be to be at least as free. Politeness is a separate issue. If you're saying, this is what it means to be polite in an increasingly diverse society, I think that's a good thing. I'm not in favor of penalizing speech. But if you say, look, you may have grown up in a particular community, but here in a diverse setting like the University of Richmond or other campuses, you're going to meet all kinds of people whose life experiences are different than yours, who have different views of how their own life is proceeding, and here's how to be polite in society, in this increasingly diverse world, which, by the way, will serve you well because America is becoming even more diverse. I think that's great. I think that's an important function of the university. I just don't favor criminalizing it.
Thank you. How to be nonpartisan, but also to take a stand for what is right in the world, in a culture that is often concerned about being politically correct and making certain to respect everyone. Is there a time of too much PC, political correctness?
Well, political correctness is, you know, something that covers many sins and everyone defines it differently. I think the evidence is pretty clear that we're shying away from a lot of difficult debates in a lot of social settings, in particular college campuses. David Brooks, in his Atlantic article a few years ago, which you may have read, I'm actually quoting in it, goes back, he actually spent a month at Princeton, and he's amazed that there are no more sharp debates in the dining halls and that he remembered in what was undoubtedly a rose-colored glasses view of his childhood. But he said, there's no debates anymore. Everyone just nods, whatever, and goes on. And he says, the campuses have lost something. Now, I will tell you that middle-aged people always think that the past was better than the current generation on a whole bunch of issues. But I think the scientific literature does suggest that we're pulling away from a lot of important debates at this moment. And we need to feel all able to be a little less comfortable in confronting and discussing what we're feeling. Because the evidence is, and I think you've referred to it, we're getting upset by these speeches, we're getting upset by speech, but we're not doing much about it. One of the other things our polling found, for instance, is an overwhelming number of young people are unhappy with what they read on social media. All this stuff about digital natives and they were born digital, students are really unhappy about the bullying, misogyny, pornography, and lots of other things they see on social media, don't know what to do about it. can't turn it off because they're afraid they won't have a life then. I think we have to be able to figure out, look, how are we going to introduce rules of etiquette? Not against by government, please, but how are people going to demand a set of national conversations, personal conversations, that are more polite and at the same time deal with these very difficult issues that we have?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're absolutely right. In a situation where, such as the University of Richmond, an institution which has become much more diverse over a 10-year period, in a rather short period of time, it is, I think, important to understand, looking at the other side of PC, that, as Dr. King said, you have to have an open heart and a willingness to understand that it's hard when you bring people together who have different backgrounds. It's hard work. It's difficult. There are going to be some challenges. And so you have to have that openness of heart.
And that's why the controversies that you mentioned and that we've talked about are so important on college campuses, because frankly, college campus, the residential campus, is one of the few places in America that's making an effort to bring a diverse group of people into a defined geographic space. The rest of the country is becoming spatially more segregated. Not by law, but it's working out that way. And so college, as important as these expressions, this speech are on college campuses to the foundations of these institutions, they're also important because the rest of America is dividing up. I mean, you could see it in the electoral map very clearly. And the college campus today, with all its problems and all the problems that you've defined, is one of the few places in America which is trying to bring a diverse group of people together and say, how can we physically live together? And I think that's a great ambition.
And I think that's the hope and opportunity for campuses such as ours, particularly smaller campuses where there is a low student-faculty ratio. I mean, you know, I've done some reading about sorting, that more and more Americans are, as you referred to a few minutes ago, kind of reveling and living in an echo chamber, living in communities where they surround people just like themselves, having affiliations with organizations where people who think just as they think are, as opposed to kind of stepping outside of that. Because it's hard. It's hard to step outside of it. And I would say, just this morning I read that Beverly Daniel Tatum's book, Why Do All the Black Kids Sit Together in the Cafeteria, has just come out at kind of 20 years after it was initially published. It's coming out sometime this week, and it includes, I heard her give a speech about it in January, some information, more information about how Americans, even those who have good intentions, still tend to segregate themselves. And I think that's the piece that really rubs up against some of the principles of free speech and, exactly. and figuring out how to give our students the tools, speaking as president here, the tools to have those conversations in thoughtful, reflective, and civil ways is, I think, our challenge that we face. One last question for you. And this has to do, and this is one from the audience. It says, a study by the Foundation for Individual Rights, FIRE, concluded 40% of 450 schools surveyed had speech codes which violated the Constitution. UR has at least one policy that substantially restricts freedom of speech. FIRE gives UR a red light rating. Do you have any comments? It's a question the person has. I don't know what that is, but what that regulation is necessarily.
I have a wonderful relationship with my colleagues at FIRE, and I've done good work with them. I think a couple of things. I think they have done a very good job about identifying problematic aspects of speech codes. I will say the speech codes bear only a rough semblance to actually what happens on campus. Sometimes administrators violate their own very good speech codes. Sometimes administrators don't don't pay any attention to, they're not so good speech codes. So it's, you can do a paper analysis of, okay, what's happening, what's on the books. Getting to what's happening on the ground, that's actually what we care about. That's that much harder. I think we can develop an inventory of best practices in terms of promoting speech within our constitutional understanding. Here, the public universities probably are ahead of the private universities just because they're required to adhere to the First Amendment and to the enormous jurisprudence behind it. But I think private universities, like I said, they have to have, and I was president of one private university, a prof at another, they have to have the ambition to be just as free as public universities. That there can't be any other decision. So I think these things have to be continually reviewed. I know FIRE didn't give, when I was at Colgate, give us such a good rating. I thought they had a point in what they identified in our particular circumstances, and I think we did good work to rectify it. So I don't know what the specific issue is, but I think these codes are important. What's really important is what's happening on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's one other question here that has to do with social media, and I do want to ask it in a slightly different way, and that is there a role that social media could play on the positive side in helping to define those boundaries and or helping to educate, if you will, folks?
It's often said, you know, the technology moves at Moore's Law, that transistor computing power doubles every 18 months, okay, which is mind-boggling when it plays out over a few years. Society does not move at Moore's Law. Society moves slowly. Regulations and laws are passed after, rightfully, great debate. We've had this complete transformation in terms of how we talk to each other, how we communicate, and we've barely had time to figure out what it means. I remember at our dinner table one day, my eldest son, who is 3 years older than my youngest daughter, said to her, "We're of a completely different generation. I'm of the MySpace generation, and you're the Facebook generation," which gave me such a headache that this is how we're moving. We need to now, that it's happened, and it will continue to evolve, but at least the contours are a little clearer, I think have a step back and say, how do we regain some sense of etiquette and politeness? I buy almost everything people say bad about social media. As I said, it's pornographic, there's bullying, there's violence, there's misogyny, there are attacks against women. I think all of that is true. There's also a lot of other things. It's allowed people to express themselves in a way that they never could before. Now, as I said, it used to be three networks and two newspapers controlled the news agenda in the United States. So basically, probably 10 to 15 white guys in New York were determining a good part of what the nation considered news. We've blown that up completely for the good, I think. And now we're trying to figure out what this world means. And we need to say, okay, some things are acceptable, some things are not. Not because government says it, but because we the people say it. For instance, one of the best developments of recent years was that the social media platform Yik Yak has gone bankrupt, right? Which Mr. Hale and I both dealt with at Colgate. And this was the bane of my existence for a while as president, because all kinds of terrible things were said on it. But it went bankrupt because at the end of the day, its particular model of anonymous posting really didn't stick. It had a shock value, worked for a little while, but it didn't stick in terms of what people wanted. While Facebook, where your true identity is supposedly disclosed, has stuck. And if I were to take, you know, a modicum of hope that we could take this communications over that so disrupted our lives and make it something that reflects the best of our ambitions, it's that some of the worst things, like Yik Yak, have gone out of business, not because government said you're bad, but because after a while the people said, not interested. And I think we just have to go a lot further down that path.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you.
You know, in the weeks leading up to this event, I've often overheard members of our community discussing the program using words such as timely and important. And I'd like to offer another, challenging or uncomfortable, or simply, as I said a few minutes ago, hard, very, very difficult. The irony of our constitutional freedoms is that they are not the least bit free. Earning our rights to speak freely or assemble peaceably or worship to any higher being we choose is hard work, and so is change. And opening yourself up to the opinions that differ from your own, and deciding where you will draw the line between censorship and free expression. Nights such as these foster the important conversations that move us closer to the understanding and mutual respect we seek in our communities, right here at the University of Richmond and other universities, and in one another. And it also shows us how to deploy reason and empathy to distinguish those with whom we respectfully disagree from those who would commit violence or propagate bigotry and hate. We ask you now, as members of the University of Richmond community, to continue these discussions in your classrooms, in D Hall, faculty lounges, residence halls, and everywhere else you gather to contemplate or to collectively talk about your futures. In fact, student leaders from both the Richmond and West Hampton College Student Government Associations and faculty have planned a follow-up discussion tomorrow morning. They'll be seeking ways to foster these important conversations on our campus. In my opinion, America is at its best when its citizens are engaged in difficult conversations that promote positive and lasting change. The University of Richmond is at its best when we do the same. We look forward to seeing you on October the 11th when we host the Virginia gubernatorial candidates. Tickets will be available starting September the 20th, or you can visit the university's website. Thank you all so very much for coming this evening. And again, a round of applause for Dr. Hurst.